Hey there, freedom fighters. Well, did I just spit on myself? 80, did you see that on your camera?
Unfortunately, the resolution wasn't that great, but...
Oh, good. Thank God for poor resolution in Skype. I'm not yet ready for high-def television. No wonder they're not inviting me to be on CNBC. All right, we don't edit it out. Joe, keep it in there because I'm going to keep on going. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the spitter and founder of Mixergy.com. And of course, that is home of the ambitious upstart. And in this interview, we're going to talk about something that we're told to do all the time. You know how you and I, as founders, we're told that we need to talk to customers before building our products, before launching our businesses? Well, today I've got an entrepreneur who did that. He checked in to see, do people even care about what he's about to build? Do they care passionately about it to fill out a form, passionately about it to pay, etc.? He did it all right, and he still failed. So I invited him here to understand why. AD Paynar is an entrepreneur who's been on Mixergy before. He's built a successful company before. He was the founder of Woo Themes. I'm looking here at my headline from the interview with him from February 2010. The headline is How Woo Themes Quietly Built a $2 million per year business selling themes. And now I invited him back here to talk about Public Beta, which was an online learning community for entrepreneurs. And I should say, it's all sponsored by Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. If you're an entrepreneur and you're starting a company later on, I will tell you why you need to go check out walkercorporatelaw.com. Now I got to welcome AD. AD, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Dude, I'm surprised you're not ashamed. I'm surprised you're not saying, hey, Andrew, you had me up there as a winner. Why do I want to come back here and do another interview and talk about my failure and, you know, leave another Google hit out there that shows that I didn't make it? Why do you even want to do this? Why did you accept this interview request?
Yeah, so I think part of it is trying to almost redo the whole journey, which probably means, you know, fail a couple of times and then actually succeed. Lucky for me, I mean, most of my little failures were kind of ran side by side to Woo Themes, which was a success. But mostly just if I have to kind of retrace the steps of the last year and the failures, the one thing I learned about myself and other entrepreneurs is there's so much, you know, stuff that entrepreneurs don't share around the, specifically, I think, the mental and emotional challenges of actually being in entrepreneurship, where it's not necessarily about tactics like finding customers or finding funding or building a product, where it's actually just about the other things, I think. I learned a lot about myself about, you know, in that, you know, regard in last year.
And I think it's just a give back thing. I learned so much about myself, and I think it's important for the world to understand what I learned so they don't make the same mistakes. That's what it is.
Yeah, well, if anyone can relate to that story, they've gone through something similar, I think, you know, that obviously helps. From my side, I'm very passionate about kind of shining a spotlight on that and saying that, you know, these things, you know, shouldn't be, you know, swept under the rug, and we should be very, very real about the challenges that entrepreneurs face, you know, in that regard.
I agree. I think we absolutely need to, and I know one of the reasons why we don't. One of the reasons is when I first did that interview with you a few years ago where we talked about how you built a multi-million dollar company doing themes, it was a huge traffic magnet for me. People love that interview. Everyone wants to learn how to build a successful company. Entrepreneurs are almost afraid to hear about someone else's failure so that it doesn't rub off on them, so it doesn't penetrate their psyche. And by being that afraid, they lose out on the insights that come from the other side of the coin. By learning from your experiences, they ignore that part of the entrepreneurship journey, and they lose out on that knowledge. But I guarantee you, as much as I love this interview, and I'm going to kick butt here today, and I know you are too, it's not going to get as much traffic. You can see the first interview got 49 comments back when hardly anyone was on the site. I don't know if we'll get the same number, but it's important. For the few people who do listen, this is going to be life-changing. How much money did you lose on the business?
Probably about $100K. Yeah.
Wow. All right. And so the first thing that you launched, was it a full-blown product or something much simpler than that?
Yeah, well, so it was something that looked like a product that wasn't a product at all. So when I initially had the idea of building this learning community, I was in a weird space back then. I actually don't know how I got there, but I was very, very risk-averse. And the kind of the last couple of months leading up to it, I read a lot about, you know, you have to validate your idea. You have to kind of do everything in your power to, you know, make sure that you're not going down, you know, kind of a bad, you know, path. And when I started Public Beta, that's what I wanted to do. So the first version of public beta, if I remember correctly, cost $2,000 or $3,000, and it was just a WordPress site that essentially marketed the different courses that were available. And most of the work there, because I mean, it wasn't a real product, most of the work actually went into getting the content, ready or at least agreed upon, which basically meant reaching out to my network, getting them to kind of commit to doing a course with the title and the description, which I kind of, came up with. And then we launched this site, and that was the first version of the site, which actually allowed you to sign up, right? And that was the very first product.
I see. So the idea was you were going to teach courses online, buy experts, and sell those courses to an audience of entrepreneurs, kind of similar to what Mixergy does, frankly.
Yep.
And where did the idea come to you?
It was something, so when I exited WooThemes, initially the thought was do something that was closely, related to that, kind of double down on the space there, use the, kind of brand equity and stuff that I built. And then I realized I actually want to do something new. And in looking at new ideas, I realized that the one thing that I really, really enjoyed at that stage of my life was, every week I'd have one or two calls on Clarity with other entrepreneurs. And I can remember that feeling of, after every one of those calls, just feeling like reinvigorated, refreshed, stimulated. So I had this idea that I, in terms of helping other entrepreneurs, that I wanted public beta to be that something, to create something that, where I might be fortunate in terms of, all the entrepreneurs on my journey with WooThemes that helped me, because I hustled hard in terms of building those relationships, but I wanted to democratize that and do it in a way, as I said, that would help other entrepreneurs as well.
All right, that makes a lot of sense. You were CEO of WooThemes at the time. Did you continue to be CEO when you launched the new business, or what was your agreement there?
No, so I stepped down as CEO end of May last year, and that was about 2 months before public beta actually launched.
Why didn't you do them concurrently?
I previously kind of burnt my fingers doing that with a little side projects. And what I learned about myself there was that I'm almost too obsessive compulsive to be able to divide my attention between between two gods and try and serve two gods, and that's how it felt in the past.
What was the past business?
Past business was called Radiate, which was to be honest, I don't even know what it was.
I see.
It became a black hole of money that that just went down the drain because it didn't have that leadership. I just didn't have the kind of mental capacity. I didn't have the time, or for that matter, the want, or the need to actually invest the same kind of leadership and vision into something on the side.
And so you said the only way that I'm going to actually turn this into something is if I focus on it obsessively. Got
exactly.
It. Okay. And so you decided I'm going to quit. Did you sell your shares in the company too?
So that happened later last year. So I basically stepped down as CEO, and about 3 months down, after that, we started the negotiations of selling my shares back to the company.
Based on what my team here and I have been looking at, it seems like you got less than $1 million in cash from selling your shares of the business.
That's probably not right.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So I got a little more than that. Ultimately, I can say, as these things go, it wasn't an aggressive kind of buyout in terms of, an acquirer coming in wanting to buy shares at ridiculous multiples. But I definitely got a very fair value for my shares in terms of the growth of the company, the company that we'd built together. But it's definitely more than that.
Wow. All right. Did you do anything crazy, like get it all in cash, throw it on the bed and jump on top of it? Or was it just sitting in a bank account?
It's sitting in a bank account. I think that's a weird thing. Maybe if I was like 21, and I didn't have a wife and I didn't have a kid and I didn't have a second one on the way, I would have probably done something crazy like that. I would have bought a new car at least. I've mostly not spent much money. I mean, most of it's gone into I would say stable investments as far as the economics kind of dictates. It's not even gone into kind of startups and stuff like that. It's just been mostly sitting there waiting for me to actually apply that in a new business, use it as a way to self-fund a new business.
I see. And so it went into public beta, for example, right?
That was the first step, yeah. I mean, that took a bit of the cash right from the start.
I see. You have the experience. You have a genuine track record. You had a big following of people who wanted to learn from you. And so you launched a site, simple WordPress site with a theme that you pay someone to customize for you, right?
Yep. Well, it wasn't a theme. We actually did something from scratch.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay. So something from scratch. And then you said, I have a few ideas for courses that we'll launch. Before we even have some customers, I'm going to create the courses. Was that right?
So we basically created outlines. I mean, that's, we had a course at that stage. The product was basically a description, a title description and a kind of a draft or vague, you know, outline of what the course would actually look like.
Did you create that before you created the landing page that I read about?
Simultaneously.
Basically. Simultaneously.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was part of the strategy is to be able to say that we actually had, or pretend, I'll use the word pretend, that there is actually a product and we had created these, you know, we had created the content.
See, that's the part that I want to make sure to pay attention to, which is you created a landing page that pretended that this product existed, which is one of the things we're supposed to do, right? To see if people react to it. If you say it's fake, mm-hmm. people are going to react differently than if you say, here it is, do you want it, right?
Yeah.
And the landing page said, as far as I can see, actually, you tell me what it said. I have a few screenshots here, but I don't know if they're as accurate as your memory.
So are you talking about the homepage itself?
Yeah, it looks like the homepage. Yeah, what did the homepage say? What was the promise that you created with the language on the homepage?
Well, I can't even remember. So
even if you don't remember the actual language, was it, here's what I see. I think I see, we're a community of entrepreneurs that help each other.
Yeah.
So the reason that I'm a little hesitant and say I think that's what it was the word community in there from the start, or was it courses for entrepreneurs that was the emphasis? So, courses or community?
Definitely community. And I can just tell you why. I always had the idea that, you know, the courses were always, or the content, let's call it the content, that would always be a segue into public beta being a learning community. And at the time, I knew when I started, I didn't necessarily know what the business model around the community would be, whereas the content, the model around that is much easier. But I always knew the business, if it were, you know, to evolve and grow, that the community was going to be an important thing, not the content as much. I definitely pushed the community aspect thereof, you know, from that one.
I see. And then underneath it says a private community, one aspect, exclusive content, another, and we will help you grow as an entrepreneur. So I'm just looking at an old archived page or old archived snapshot of that page. So I can't exactly see what happens, but I do see that there's a button that says become a member. When you launched the site originally, when people clicked become a member, what happened?
Yeah, so I mean, you could basically get to that, you know, well, after you went to a sign-up page, like same sign-up page as you would get on any kind of SaaS app or purchasing any digital your product. So, and you could basically get there, as you say, from the homepage or from the actual kind of, you know, we had a library page that all had all these courses, as I said, with the titles and description, and obviously the other, you know, part thereof, which was the social proof.
Oh, I see. So even though there was no content created, you still created a library of content that when people bought in, they supposedly could see. And of course, it doesn't exist. You didn't have a community yet. All right. But you still let them sign up for the community. Great. Yep. This is everything that they tell us in the lean startup movement and the new entrepreneurial movement that you're supposed to do. Did you also accept payment? That's another thing that you're supposed to do.
Yeah. So what we did is we actually ran it through, through the whole billing system, but we didn't charge the actual customer or that actual person signing up. So we put through a $0 kind of authorization, I think, is what essentially happened. So nobody got charged at that stage. But obviously what we tried to do, the aim there was to kind of simulate a real world kind of purchasing, you know, kind of a consensus almost, right? So offering something, and someone is actually willing to give me their credit card details. That was the important thing that I, you know, wanted to validate there. It wasn't just something I'm, you know, signing up, for a beta or something like that. I'm registering interest. Right. It was actually, I was willing to give this guy credit card details because I wanted what he had an offer.
Because if the landing page said, coming soon, do you want to join? Then Yeah, you'll get people who are interested, but many of them are just looky-loos. They just want to see what is 80 going to do next. But if you say you have to sign up by filling out this form and you have to give a credit card, then you know you're getting people who are really committed. And what you want to see is, are people encouraged by this, inspired by this enough that they would want to put a credit card down to pay? It was more about that than it was about the money, which is why you didn't charge anything. Super. Everything looks great here. How many people did you get to fill out this process?
It was around about 80 odd people. So it basically accounted to
80 people almost, who paid.
Yeah.
So who went through the motions of paying. Great. How did you get so many people when there wasn't a product out there?
So what I'd done previously, I at least built a mailing list of about 2,000 people, prior to that, which was the bulk of it came from beta list initially, just listing a little, coming soon homepage. So that's where those kind of emails, helped. And then I did a lot of writing, in the months leading up to it. And
writing on your personal blog.
Yeah.
Okay.
All on my personal blog, and just kind of loads of links back to, or references at least to this new thing that I was building. So got to about 2,000, emails on the list prior to launch. So that obviously helped. That definitely gave it that little, bump, in initial signups. Go for it.
Betalist.com is a site where people who are interested in upcoming products go to find out about them. You listed your product on there, and that's where you got some traffic. I know that you even did an interview with Betalist, right? They do Mixergy style interviews.
Yeah.
Right? Did that help at all for getting traffic?
Yeah, a little bit. So, one of those little things, helped. The bulk of it definitely. I got about 800, email addresses within the first 2 or 3 weeks, just from Betalist. So that was a fantastic kind of, very kind of scattergun kind of, source of leads, but at least it was leads. I mean, it definitely helped build the mailing list initially.
Okay. So far we're getting good validation. You're going into the startup community. That's what Betalist reaches. And you're saying, this is what I'm creating. Anyone interested? People are saying, yes, I'm interested. And they're coming in and filling out the process and paying. Incredible. Great. What did you do with those people once they were on the list? You didn't charge them, but you did want to learn a little bit about them. How did you do that?
Yeah, so the first thing we did there that that kind of stepped on a few people's toes is, so we kept up this kind of spiel for about the first week before anyone knew. So as soon as you then hit sign up, you actually completed sign up, we did something similar very superficially, but you essentially had to kind of your number 2,000 odd in the queue. Kind of mailbox did initially before they launched, right?
Did everybody get an email that said you're number 2,000?
No. So what we did is, the way we kept that dynamic is, we essentially imported those 2,000 odd people that was on the mailing list as users within the WordPress system. That was actually just the user account within WordPress. So again, it was kind of superficially, it wasn't entirely the truth, but it wasn't untrue.
No, it's not untrue at all. What you're saying is you're adding them in WordPress users. WordPress automatically puts a number next to everyone. And so you're able to say you are number whatever it is. That's not untruth. That's actually a very simple solution for a tough problem of figuring out how do you assign a number. All right, great.
So the WordPress experience from all those years, Ruthie, definitely helped there. So we did that. We kept, for a week after that, I didn't reach out to those people. And thereafter, we actually started telling people, there isn't any content. And just for anyone that, is obviously listening or watching now, to understand why there wasn't any content is, the content had a very kind of big cost to it. We were talking about $2,000-$3,000 to get these videos professionally produced, right? And that's about a half an hour of content at that price, which meant to do the 40 courses that we kind of promised to do, up front. Quick math, we're talking, say, another 150K.
Which Why? Is a massive- Why didn't you just say, hey, you know what? Screw it. I know I love design. I'm great at design. I'll put a nice bumper before and after the course, and the content will be what we create that's great. And later on, we'll spend the money on making it look more polished.
Well, so at that stage, I think that was part of the business model, right? For me, I wanted something that was high fidelity, where, also kind of very much condensed. So within, 15 or 20 minutes, or even half an hour is kind of the cutoff in terms of putting a little course together. I wanted something that's, very, very actionable in a short space of time, something that's not too long, something that's not, not a narrative. It's very, as I said, so, you know, actually, that's the best word I had. And having the production value was a differentiator from, you know, what was out there, you know, on the web, at the, you know, at that stage, at least. So that was part of it. And as I said, I mean, I wasn't willing to kind of front invest that amount of capital in something that I didn't know would have legs, or the extent to which it had legs.
So if I say, hey, AD, why didn't you make it a lot uglier at first and just launch it? You say, no, that's not the vision here. And I want to see if people are buying into the vision. I'm not looking to sacrifice my vision. I'm looking to validate my vision or invalidate it.
So that's part thereof. Another consideration, so the content itself is going to come from other entrepreneurs. So if you take someone, you know, good friends of mine like Heaton Shaw, for example, he committed to doing, you know, a course actually, you know, on idea validation. So now I'm dealing with someone that's already super busy, already has too many things to do in life. He's volunteered his time to help me out to teach other entrepreneurs. So I basically have like, you know, 2 or 3 hours once, like, you know, one slot to get, he can sit down with the cameraman and actually get this thing shot, right? So it wasn't something, you know, I wanted to maximize that opportunity, that goodwill that, you know, 40 entrepreneurs showed and volunteering their time and basically get the whole thing done, you know, right there, you know, and then. Because I knew I wouldn't have the opportunity to kind of go back and redo those initial videos. That's, you know, if that makes sense.
All right. So you're putting people on the list. You're thinking about whether they want this new video concept badly enough to pay for it. You're also starting to have a conversation with them, right?
Yep.
How did you talk to them?
So about a week or so afterwards, I started reaching out to customers, and I did customer, you know, interviews, voice calls, which was a new thing for me, by the way. I mean, I hate a phone, any kind of phone, and I'd never done with. That's the thing with WooThemes. I never did that. We never did those kind of customer interviews. Things were much more organic and different, right? So I started talking to people, and that's what I heard so many times in the interviews and the calls we had, was this focus on the community. Like, what people wanted was, the content would have been great, but they can mostly kind of scratch that itch elsewhere. That's what they felt. But the, you know, thing that they felt they missed out on was that community, that accountability of having like-minded peers around you, and specifically support. You know, the emotional and mental support. So, and this was kind of confirmed. So I had about 15, 20 calls, right? Where the same kind of themes came through.
They just say over and over, we want community. How does it express themselves? No one says, I want community.
So they expressed it as accountability and emotional support. That was the two kind of main things.
They say, I want accountability from other people.
Yeah. So, well, they said they struggle with accountability. They struggle with the kind of emotional aspects of being an entrepreneur. Many of these people were solo founders. I mean, that was something else I can mention as well. So it's people that, you know, they probably, you know, kind of sit at home, you know, in front of a computer all day, you know, working away, hustling away at building this thing. But they never, you know, that doesn't leave space to just kind of, as I said, kind of get support from other like-minded entrepreneurs on a wide variety of things. That's a very kind of tactical approach. Or what happens there is it's easier to get the kind of the tactical support in terms of, you know, the A, B, and C, what should I do next kind of thing.
I see. Okay. All right. That makes sense. So now you're really learning what they want. What does that say to you about this vision for a beautifully designed course with a top guy like Heaton Shaw? Is it as important anymore, or do you decide, you know, I should back burner that?
Yeah, so we completely backburner that. So we started that stage. I made 2 full-time hires to start building the product, which at that stage is this kind of hybrid between a community with like a built-in accountability tracker, almost like goal tracking, almost, but in a kind of peer-to-peer way. And we even called it that stage, that pivot. I had you know, illusions of grandeur, and we started calling Runkeeper for entrepreneurs, which made so much sense. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, stuff that I think VCs kind of eat up, right?
Runkeeper is a really successful, not just mobile app, but a community for athletes. I use Runkeeper every time when I go for a run. And it does keep me accountable. It keeps track of how many runs I've done and so on. And if I add a friend on it, then we can keep each other accountable. I get it. All right. So you're thinking now venture capitalist also. Is that a problem that you're thinking venture capitalist at this point?
Yeah. Why? Because it contradicted, you know, everything that at least I knew about myself and the way I thought about business. And at that stage, it just didn't. It became that was the thing, you know, I started aiming for, you know, to build this thing to get, you know, VCs interested. And I think that's why, you know, well, that's the first time or the first kind of pivot point, literally, where I felt I lost the plot in hindsight. That wasn't the company I set out to build. And that definitely convoluted, you know, the strategy, the roadmap, everything.
I see. No customer was saying to you, 80, what I really need is Runkeeper for my business. It was your understanding of what venture capitalists wanted.
Well, yes or no. What I'm saying is I think there was the customers definitely wanted this community thing, and I think we were on something with the goal tracking. I actually think for anyone that wants to build it, there's probably still space to do it, but the business model changes inherently there. So we're... it's much easier to sell something as tangible, like content, whereas now I'm going into that kind of fluffy side of entrepreneurship where I'm talking about emotional support and accountability and stuff. And my perception, and that's where, and we launched a little MVP, little WordPress site to kind of validate this, and there was interaction, but then the kind of the selling gets harder. So that's the typical kind of thing that idea in my mind, at least, where like having the venture backing, being able to build a product for a year or two is great because you can evolve to the point where it is valuable and you can start charging for it. But again, that completely contradicts my mindset about bootstrapping, charging, you know, if not day one, as soon as possible, not investing this massive amounts of money in terms of, you know, building a product and then eventually kind of, you know, kind of adding revenue to it.
So Eddie, actually, this is the part that I don't understand. If because it seems like a great idea. Frankly, I hear it from the Mixergy audience all the time. They want accountability. They want goal setting, right? So you built that product for them already. Are you saying that you needed more time to get it right, or?
Yeah. So we built, you know, kind of MVP of that, and there was definitely traction. I mean, I think that's the thing people should know. There was definitely traction, and and then we got derailed further, both me personally, and I'm happy to get into that. I made a bad hire in terms of product that, you know, that definitely kind of further derailed things.
What's the bad hire?
It was bad kind of judgment call on my part in terms of, you know, someone that I entrusted to kind of lead product, and it just didn't work out.
The person couldn't develop the product that you wanted.
Yeah.
Because?
Yeah. Skills and character, I think.
What do you mean, you know, by character?
Just the alignment with the way I work. I mean, it isn't criticism of the individual, and, you know, itself, it just wasn't a fit, you know, in terms of how things, you know, were supposed to work out. And you know, at that stage, once you've invested in someone, even if at that stage it was only a month or two, you kind of, it's hard, you know, in terms of just saying, you know, you call it quits and you figure something out. I literally threw, you know, good money off a bad stage. As I said, what I should have done was call it quits and
hire someone else.
And reboot. Yeah.
So that's one thing. I made a promise to the audience that as they listen to this, even though it's not like the super inspiring story of a guy who went from nothing to making millions a year and now has a Ferrari and sleeps on dollar bills, even though they don't get that story, I want to make sure that they get what they need, which is learning from your experiences so that they don't make the same mistakes and so they build better companies and hopefully come back and send you thank you notes in the future and say, hey, because of you, this is what I was able to do. And so one thing we've learned is, if it's not a good fit, especially when you're in the early stage of a fast-growing company, you got to cut ties and start with someone else. What about on hiring? When we're trying to hire a developer, do you have any advice for how to hire so that we get the right fit?
Definitely, that's the thing. Is, and I said I made a bad judgment call. I very much believe, and I think this is the most kind of fail-proof, you know, or foolproof way to do it is to hire, you know, people and not skills, right? So skills definitely being second. I mean, most, especially technical people, most people should be able, especially, we're talking early versions and it's not the most technical thing in the world, like building the next Twitter or Facebook, that kind of thing. But most people technically should be able to kind of execute in that. But people in terms of having that alignment and personalities, characteristics, passions, that's basically the stuff that I, you know, I'm looking at. That's where we, you know, I had most success in Wii Games as well, where there was a larger overlap of those four individuals we hired. That's where we hire the most successful in, you know, individuals.
I see. You also say that if you're building something where you're charging quickly, it changes the way that you build your product. How?
Well, because, I mean, then I think to some extent it's much easier whilst kind of bootstrapping is a discipline. But having that constraint means priorities, some, you know, become much easier. So because you have two priorities there. One is I build stuff for new customers. One is I build stuff to retain my existing customers. And especially the latter is relatively easy to figure out. Once you have a paying customer, they'll tell you, like, listen, you're 80, I'm not going to continue paying you because you don't have X. And if, you know, 50% of those people that are currently paying you tell you you don't have X, it's an easy decision. So you simply use the revenue you have to just kind of fuel, you know, that next phase without having to make those kind of, again, that kind of scattergun guess about what people want. And my caution there is I know I can go ask anyone on the web what they want me to build. The problem is, like, my opinion, the feedback that you get from people that's not paying you is actually worth jack shit. Like when they're not paying you, it's not from a validated source.
So did you go back to people who weren't paying you and get their feedback?
No,
you stuck. You did stick with your paying customers, and they're the ones who you were building for because they're the ones who showed that they're willing to pay. All right. You told April Dykeman in our Mixergy pre-interview that you were tracking metrics geared towards fundraising, not customer acquisition. What were those metrics starting to become for you?
It was all around engagement. So at that stage, literally pushing engagement metrics. So the things we were doing on MVP, stuff like logging in, you know, multiple times a day, kind of to show that this was a crutch people were using on a daily basis. The kind of interaction, so, you know, kind of questions answered, questions received, or answers received from, you know, from within the community. And eventually the what we never properly got to was very MVP-ish, was the goal tracking. So people kind of setting goals and completing goals. Obviously in a public environment. Those, from the top of my head, those were the kinds of metrics.
Did you keep track of that metric? The goal, how close they got to the goal?
Well, not how close they got to it. We would just have a very binary. They kind of added a goal.
Got it. And so was that a metric that you were keeping track of? And I see it. And that you should have been keeping track of.
Yeah.
Okay. But what you shouldn't have is you're saying how often they're logging in. Isn't that, that's not that important?
No. So that was part of it. Yeah. I mean, so all those things as, so that, and again, so that from a bootstrap mindset, you know, where the kind of KPIs or the most important metrics that, you know, we were tracking went from sort of revenue to something like engagement was a very big shift, at least in mentality and mindset of how to build a business.
I see. And if you could do it over again, you wouldn't be focusing on engagement. You'd focus on paying customers. Am I getting more paying customers with this feature? That's the metric that you need to focus on when you're in a hustle stage.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
the thing I can add here is a caveat to that is I think the latter is fine. I think there's, again, like it's fine to build that kind of engagement level company, but it's a big, you know, kind of foundation level kind of decision you make at that stage. And I know in hindsight that that's one that doesn't sit, you know, overly well, you know, with me. As I'm much more a bootstrapper than I'll ever be a venture back, you know, entrepreneur.
And that's what people admire about you. That's why people want to be a part of the community. They want to see how a guy who has no resources can build something from scratch. And that's what you did with WooThemes. Speaking of WooThemes, we're roughly at the stage where you go back to the WooThemes team and you say, I'm going to cash out. Was that an easy process? Was it like selling a stock on the market? No, of course not. What was it like?
No. Divorce. That's definitely what it felt like. I think, you know, a lot has been said about kind of co-founder relationships, right? And I think the one thing that I've learned is no co-founder relationship ever is perfect. And what the kind of the mindset kind of meant, I think that process inherently and naturally shines the spotlight on all the shittiest things without kind of ever, you know, taking in, you know, just kind of remembering all the good stuff that was there. The good stuff, which is ultimately the ultimate good thing, was that together we built this, you know, massive, massive business that we're now kind of quibbling about in terms of, you know, valuation and, you know, kind of the semantics around that. But the emotional strain, I mean, the process back and forth definitely lasted for months.
How are you? I know you're not going to tell me about how Magnus was shitty or Mark was crappy. How about you? What part is the jerky part of your personality that came through because of the sale?
The part where you only like want the best for your family. I mean, it's
the part that just needs money right now. And I see, and you can't wait for them to take a long time, and you can't be nice and accept half of what you deserve. I see.
Exactly. And I mean, so that's a thing. I think, and that was a weird thing. That's the other thing I can say, you know, publicly is money is a weird thing for me, because money doesn't motivate me, right? Getting, you know, double amount of money from a sale like that wasn't going to motivate me. But I definitely felt a responsibility, and I still feel that responsibility today to extract fair value in relation to what, you know.
So it's not about the money; it's about the fairness.
That's the fairness, and that has a monetary component. I mean, the way to measure that ultimately is, you know, in dollars. And as I said, I was definitely aware of what this would mean for my family. Not just kind of saying, you know what, let's not quibble about this. You know, whatever you guys say is fine. I'll walk away, and that was it. I definitely felt like I had a responsibility to my family to extract the maximum fair value.
How long did it take you to separate from WooThemes? How many months of negotiating?
3 to 4 months.
3 to 4. All right, that's not bad.
Yeah, well, if you say so, I mean, it felt
it did. Like it could be so much more for people, but it sounds like that was even tougher too. Wow, so you go from one business to the other with a little bit of overlap, and that overlap is you trying to figure out a new business, talk to customers, figure out who you're going to hire, and get a divorce, not from one person, but from two people. That's intense. Why don't I take a moment here in this minute of intensity and say that, look, if you out there are an entrepreneur and you need a lawyer, especially if you're feeling especially cuddly and cozy with your co-founder, think about a lawyer who's going to help preserve your relationship long term. And that lawyer, I believe, is Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. He will help you not just set up your company right, but also set up your relationship with your co-founders right. So if you ever do need a divorce, it's like a prenup agreement so that you know what happens in the case of a divorce. But hopefully you will not go through that. And what's more important is, when it's time for you to raise money, you're not going to have this crappy company that makes no sense to investors. You're going to have a company that's ready to take on investment. And more importantly, if you're already at the stage where you're ready to buy a company, you want a lawyer who's done it multiple times. You want a lawyer who's ready to take you to the next level, whatever that is for you as an entrepreneur, and who's not going to say, hey, you know what, I'm going to learn with you because I've never done it before. You want a lawyer who's done it so many times that many of the top entrepreneurs in the tech space and the startup space already know, like, and recommend him. And that lawyer, of course, is Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. If you want to find out more about him, go to walkercorporatelaw.com. But before I end the sponsorship spot, AD, do you have any advice as an entrepreneur who's been through so much for other entrepreneurs who need lawyers? Any legal advice at all? It doesn't even have to be about Scott Edward Walker.
Spend the money.
I think a little bit of money on it.
Yeah, I mean, my wife's an attorney, so and I'll add that I don't love lawyers at all. But you know, the experience definitely. I wish, as a company, we'd probably spent more time and money on it initially. I think that would have definitely helped. So yeah, spend the money. I know it's not fun money to spend. There is, but it's definitely worthwhile in long term.
You know what? And people showed me what Scott charges. I thought it was going to be so expensive to set things up right. And I said, who has that kind of money, especially over the time? I saw the bills. It's not that high. It's really much more reasonable than we expect. Okay, so now you're continuing. I talked about all this stuff that's now on your shoulders, and it actually is starting to seep out. You actually had, where is it in my notes here? You had a conversation with someone on your team about a couple of new features. The woman on your team asked you a simple question. Your reaction was, you're smiling. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, totally. So I can remember the conversation, and I didn't tell her this, obviously, but in my head, I wanted to mute Skype, and I wanted to say, like, fuck, I can't make any more decisions. That's literally how it felt. Like, I literally felt like, why are you asking me this, this question? Why do you want me to, even consider this, kind of feature addition? It definitely, I mean, and now I know there's a, kind of name for that, which was decision fatigue, but that's definitely what it felt like. I just, like, within that split second that she asked me that question, it literally just kind of, sent me over a edge. That I
I see,
didn't
it was
even
just
know
one
that
more
I was kind of
decision.
there.
I can't make any more decisions. I'm so tired of this. You guys need to do this for you. And I'm surprised that you were able to actually hold back and not just let that loose by accident.
Yeah. So, but yeah. So that's where that kind of almost ended, or that another kind of perspective. That's where it started kind of a new journey for me in terms of kind of dealing with that reality that I'd suddenly found myself in. One that I almost, well, I definitely didn't admit it to people around me, my wife, my family, closest friends, and myself. I think I think as entrepreneurs, we're trained to bullshit everyone, mostly ourselves. So yeah.
What do you mean by trained to bullshit everyone? How?
So, like, as founder and later on as CEO, like, you're always that buffer, for all stakeholders. So when when things go bad, like, you're the one downplaying it, you're taking it yourself because it shouldn't go to the team, or the investor shouldn't worry, or whatever. Or back home, you don't tell your wife that you're struggling at work because you don't want her to necessarily worry about paying bills and that kind of thing. So you became that, the kind of sole conduit for all this kind of stress. And the kind of the emotional and mental challenge of figuring out how to go about things. And I do think that we bullshit. Like, we say things, we either over exaggerate the kind of minor victories, or we kind of completely ignore the failures or challenges or stumbling blocks along our way, because we want to give people positive and optimistic news, and feedback all the time.
Yeah. And frankly, I don't know the alternative. I've talked to other entrepreneurs who say you need to level with people, but does someone really want to come into work hearing all your problems? And then if they do come into work hearing all your problems, they want to start giving you feedback and advice, but they're not in a position to give you helpful feedback and advice. So now you're getting tons of different feedback, tons of different advice from lots of people, and you have to figure out what to do without hurting their feelings while you're trying to run your company and deal with other problems.
Exactly. And that, so the weird thing there was, and this probably was a saving grace, and at least in terms of keeping me standing, is it's about 2.5 years ago now. I joined an organization called EO, Entrepreneurs Organization, and I essentially have kind of monthly mastermind group with seven entrepreneurs locally. We meet for 5 hours, and I could take these things to them, and that definitely helped. So in terms of, I agree. I didn't necessarily think, you should level. In terms of, you shouldn't necessarily level completely with your spouse or partner. You shouldn't go back to the team because you don't necessarily want them to stress. But I definitely felt that I could take this to this group of friends that I kind of built through this organization, where they could understand. And the interesting thing there is the organization, the protocol is not to give advice at all. It's just experience sharing and validation, actually. So I always left those meetings feeling I'm not going crazy. And irony in all that was, that was a big part of what I wanted public beta at that stage to be, was exactly that kind of space for entrepreneurs to feel like, I'm not going crazy. I'm hustling. I'm struggling. I'm hustling, and I can kind of keep, stay optimistic and positive in terms of, overcoming those challenges.
See, so you shouldn't have to tell everybody, but you should have someone that you can talk to about this.
definitely.
All right, so I see the stress, and I see that that's becoming a problem. I see that you're serving almost two masters at the same time, your community and their current needs, and at the same time, venture capitalists and their potential needs. What's happening, though, to the product?
At that stage, I eventually, let the individual go that led the product on that side, the bad hire I mentioned
Okay.
earlier. And I went back to kind of what I know best, which was to hack a product together myself, which is, you know, kind of crazy scary to think about that. You know, I basically let all of my technical skills slide whilst focusing on the business side of WooThemes all those years. But
you were coding up the community features of the site.
Yeah, so gotcha. That was the last product. I mean, that product never shipped because from that kind of, you know, doing that phase of the product development, that's where I had the conversation where I totally flipped about the additional features that I had to consider. After that, after I had this epiphany that I just couldn't take it anymore, we actually shut the business down. I made the decision to shut it down completely, shut down the product. At that stage, there was paying customers. About 70 odd on monthly subscriptions, and I refunded them for the last month that I paid for, and just closed the business.
Ah, I see. So you let go of people. You said I can't handle it anymore, and it wasn't so much the customer development, customer interview process that failed. It was you who was so burnt out from years of WooThemes, from figuring out this new thing, from not taking a break, from going through a business divorce, that you just said, I have to take a pause.
Yeah, totally. And I think the biggest mistake there that I can now kind of smile about was not listening to my wife. I mean, the odd thing about all of it is we had actually agreed on that we want, you know, when I eventually left WooThemes, which is always a plan, you know, in the longer term, I would actually take a break, you know, whether it's for a month, 6 months, a year, whatever the case was, I would take a break before starting something new. I at that stage, I just realized that that's what I kind of should have done. I should have taken that break, rebooted, refreshed, and tackled this new startup with kind of that renewed energy.
I do see how the product, though, shifted that. Where before there was a link to a library and a description of content that was to come later on, I'm looking at November 29th, 2013, a screenshot there says, does the startup roller coaster suck at times? Don't worry, it does for everyone. Public beta is a community of like-minded entrepreneurs that help you make progress on your goals and overcome challenges and emotions that you encounter on this roller coaster ride. I don't see anywhere in this homepage screenshot where you talk about the content. I do see where you just talk about goals, and the screenshot is place for people to chat and talk about it, and that's where the product evolved. And you were doing great, except you just didn't have the energy to keep moving.
Yeah, I mean, and as context there, I mean, I think you know, all those shifts, the you know, kind of pivots in terms of the product, having that illusion of grandeur, kind of considering building something that's venture backed when that wasn't the initial plan. I mean, those are all kind of, I would say, the natural challenges that most entrepreneurs face, right? We don't necessarily know what's, you know, a month or 6 or 2 years down the line. We just adapt to those things. Those kind of small little forks in the road, you know, came about and I reached them, I just didn't have the energy and the passion, I think, ultimately to kind of figure out a way past those.
Would keeping it simpler have helped earlier on, so that it doesn't take up so much time, or is it naturally going to have to take up a lot of time?
Yeah, so it comes back to kind of, you know, not trying to serve two gods at one time. I personally think I'm just too kind of obsessive compulsive to do something, you know, half-assed. So slow doesn't work for me in that sense. Plus, you know, trying to both rest we'll take a break and, you know, kind of slowly start building a new thing. Again, those two things are at odds. I mean, that just is a perfect environment to feel conflicted and not know where the priorities are and have that spill over between these two things. And then ultimately, and what happened was that neither one of those kind of ultimately succeed. You wouldn't be able to take a break, nor would, you know, new thing, or, you know, or this new thing would not be likely to succeed.
How did you feel about making customer calls? After you started doing them, did it get better?
The calls itself, yeah. I mean, so that's the thing. The interesting thing about public beta was I definitely set out to apply all the new knowledge that I kind of learned over the years with stuff that I either read about, stuff that, you know, we learn from, you know, making mistakes and then figuring out a better way. Having these customer interviews with customers, it was something that I challenged myself to do. And yeah, I mean, I enjoyed them ultimately. I mean, it's not something I would want to wake up every day and do necessarily, but in that sense, I definitely felt that Public Beta was this new challenge that I found stimulating, new skills that I could apply, a new opportunity to apply those skills in a real life environment. So yeah, I mean, I learned a lot doing it.
So Adi, when I do interviews with people who talk about the customer interview process, where you need to interview your customers and then build product for them and so on, sometimes I worry that I make it sound too easy, and it really isn't so easy. Where are the hard parts of it that we need to be aware of?
I think the hard part is listening, like really listening, and being aware of any biases. So, I mean, my bias, as I mentioned, I mean, with my experience with an EO and my own kind of mastermind group, I knew how valuable that was. So the more people said community, the more I heard that, and I went back to my own bias, my own experience in that regard. So I think the key challenges, and I probably don't have a kind of a real answer in terms of if I had listened, been a better listener, I had kind of distilled, you know, down to absolute T what people, you know, what the customers wanted, whether I would have changed the decisions back then. But I think that's the real challenge there is really, really, really hearing, you know, what people want and being able to then shift that around in terms of how that should kind of influence the, you know, your next couple of steps. But that's, I think, the biggest.
I see. You're saying maybe they didn't really want a community. Maybe they didn't need the goal setting button on the left where they type in their goal and hit submit. Maybe all they wanted was a simple chat place. Maybe if I just even gave them Facebook as a community as opposed to even a WordPress-based community that I built from scratch, that would have been simpler. But your bias was, and we all have it, to say, I can code it.
Exactly.
Got it. By the way, I'm shifting in my seat a whole lot. I should say why. So if you look right over there, you can see the power, right?
Yes.
Which is a little distracting in the interviews, so I've started to lift up the camera. But if I lift up the camera, I need to not keep my chair down here, which is what might be comfortable to work, because then I look small on camera, so I have to go up higher. Problem with going up higher is now my thighs touch the desk. But I'm working on design. Unlike you, I don't gravitate towards design naturally. So I'm working on it. One new addition today is I have a t-shirt on underneath this, because when I wear my regular shirt, apparently my chest hair bleeds through and Olivia can see it. She said, you gotta put, this is what I came into work with, this shirt. It looks pretty nice, but apparently it's a little thin. So Olivia said, put on a t-shirt underneath. So I have it. But this t-shirt goes all the way down to here. Should I show you?
Yeah, go for it.
I have so much chest hair. I think I might lose listeners over this. I'd be so disgusted. I go, this is a little too. Look, there it is right there. So now I'm.
I wouldn't be too concerned about listeners. I would be concerned about whoever from CNBC is, you know, watching this.
CNBC is never going to have me on. Do you see how I, first of all, I spit at the top of the interview. Second, yeah. I shift. Can you imagine, like, if you're listening to, like, Larry King or someone and all he's doing? Actually, I believe he does. I believe he does, and the editor shifts away.
Well, did he do it on day one, though, when he was trying to make a name for himself?
Oh, when he was trying to make a name for himself, he was drunk on New York radio. You could listen to him ramble on for a while. There are people who email me all the time, his drunk recordings, because he was drunk on camera. So, you know,
also,
what?
Then you have a future.
I'm preparing for it. I'm wearing this. I'm going to start to look a little bit better. And I should start asking more intelligent questions too. Actually, no, my questioning, I think, is where I really put a lot of my emphasis. It's the design that now I need to step up a notch with, and I am. All right. What about this? Is it possible that because you got more than $1 million that you just didn't need it as much? You just suddenly had some money. You have to go and use it. It is.
Yeah. There's multiple things. I mean, I think what many people don't consider, I've definitely felt this, you know, the second time in terms of starting up was harder. I mean, both having that money, so being able to self-fund, you know, a business. And that was something interesting that Heath Shaw actually told me in conversation. He said he realized there's a big difference between bootstrapping and self-funding, you know, a business. Because at that stage, for me, it was, you know, one and the same thing. So having that money, I mean, it immediately takes certain pressures, you know, off of it. And the big thing that I struggled personally with at that stage was having that space, both in funding and now kind of experience and knowing where the pitfalls are, all those kinds of things. I was fearful of the fact that I would never go back to the point where I was literally hustling to save my life. That kind of, that survival instinct, that thing that I had when I started up initially when I didn't have much to do, but you know, you also don't want to kind of fail. So yeah, I mean, I kind of past success initially made.
You said I don't ever want to go back to that hustle, and if it means that I take a gamble by paying for salary for someone for too long and I don't get it back, I'm not willing to do it. That yeah, going so, back to the hustle where I need to make the bills, never again.
Well, so yes, and so partly not the hustle necessarily. I would love to, and building a new product right now, I can tell you I have that hustle back, right? But I, at that stage, what I'm saying is with Polybeta, I was fearful that I wouldn't have that kind of, you know, hustle anymore. You know, that it was just too luxurious. And then, yes, what you're saying, though, is there's definitely a part of me that said, you know, the success I had has built a certain level, if I can call it that, of life for myself, my family. And ideally, I wouldn't compromise on that. You know, so that's where the kind of risk averse comes in, right? In terms of just saying, well, I can take all the money I made from WooThemes and just risk it on something. You know, I wouldn't do that because I wouldn't want to go back, you know, 10 steps again.
You know, I think that there might be a difference between bootstrapping and self-funding. We connect them both the same. As long as you're not taking outside money, you're technically bootstrapping your company. But it's different if you're putting money into the business than if you're not at all. And I found for myself, when I bootstrapped the first version of Mixergy, which was an invitation site, I was self-funding it. I had cash. I spent hundreds of thousands, 300 I think it was, on the business. And that's a mistake. Putting my own money into the business is a big mistake because, unlike an investor who puts money in, I don't have to justify myself to myself where I would have to investor. And unlike officially, truly bootstrapping, I don't have to justify myself to my customers and say, do you like this enough to pay for me to go build it or continue it? And so that in-between place of self-funding, I think, is very dangerous. And I know for me, it was very dangerous.
Yeah, totally. And that's why, I mean, anyone that asks me what I think about bootstrapping, I absolutely love bootstrapping. But bootstrapping is ultimately, it's a discipline more than and a kind of vehicle, more than as a source of funding. So I completely agree. I mean, I think it's possible to bootstrap when self-funded or venture-backed or, you know, neither of the two. But I definitely, as I said, I couldn't at that stage of Polybeta, confuse that, those two things. And I did the same thing as you did. I think I... You know, due to the luxury I was afforded, the space I was afforded, I ignored a bunch of signals that I should probably not have ignored.
Also, I remember Heaton telling me this and other entrepreneurs saying that if you are going to talk to your customers, don't build out what they want. Build out the simplest version of what you think can satisfy what they need and what their problem is. And if you're spending money on developers, maybe that doesn't push you to create the simplest version. Is that right?
I mean, yeah, totally. And I mean, I think... ultimately, whilst building out the simplest version is sometimes very, very easy to say, and it's possible to do that for validation purposes, right? But in terms of actually selling something that's very, very simple, especially where, and again, this is something interesting to note, I think Polybeta was the later versions was much more of a vitamin than it ever was a painkiller, which then means if you have a very simple version, people just don't pay for that, right? The urgency, because it's not that big
I'm
a thing.
I'm not going to pay just to chat with people, but I am going to pay for a really good solution to a problem, and I see. So if you would have just said, hey, doesn't roller coaster of startups suck at times? Do you want to pay to chat with other people? Wouldn't have gone over as well. I get that.
Exactly.
What about the getting new leads? You can only do one interview on, Beta List that we talked about earlier that sent you some traffic. Your list, I thought, was in the hundreds of thousands, but it's a personal private mailing list, which has, 3,000 people today. So that also is harder when you're starting out, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, and I can say this, that's probably one of my biggest regrets in terms of exiting from WooThemes is not having that conduit where you suddenly have, I think when I left WooThemes, I had the email addresses of over 500,000 people, right? So not having that foundation, that kind of obvious channel to kind of do things, or to build a new business or new product, was a challenge. And again, that's a mind, kind of change in mindset. But then again, I mean, that's where the hustle comes from, right? I mean, that's the adrenaline and the challenge that comes with, building a new business, figuring out new channels of finding the customers that finds the product helpful. So I wasn't too concerned about that. I mean, I think, from the get-go, I had about $2,500 in recurring revenue, within the first you know, couple of weeks.
How much?
So
how much money recurring?
About $2,500.
That's pretty damn good.
Yeah. So I mean, in terms of, you know, being a recurring business, you know, right off, you know, from the start, having that kind of revenue, that's nice traction just there. I mean, it's probably at that stage not a $1 million idea, but it's you know, start of a nice little business. Again,
here's what I got, Amy. I think you were on track. I think the fact that you got $2,500 a month in recurring revenue is proof that you were on track. Could you have kept the product simpler? Absolutely. Could you have maybe hired someone a little bit later after you understood the product, or maybe found someone who was more in line with you who could keep shifting and building the product as you need? Absolutely. And you would have probably done all of that. And you could have built it from, if you got to $2,500 so quickly, to maybe $10,000. Fairly quickly and broken even and continue the product. I think this process would have worked for you, except that you were burnt out, that you didn't take a break, you didn't listen to your wife, right? So if we were to learn a big lesson from this, it's yes, this customer interviewing process does work. It will take some time, but it will work if you focus on keeping it simple enough that you can maintain it long enough to see it through. You're going to be okay, and take some time so you don't burn out.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately, and again, it sounds narcissistic, but I think in every business, the entrepreneur is the most important, you know, important person in that business. And if you're not taking care of yourself, you know, whatever that means, but if you're not taking care of yourself, and I think all of this kind of bullshit of, you know, being able to push yourself for weeks on end and doing like 16-hour days, and then after that taking a break, I don't think that works. I think it's a consistent kind of thing on a daily basis, you know, whether it's meditation or exercise, whether it's peer group, whatever it is, you have to take care of yourself holistically. Otherwise, like, I think most people eventually just run out of steam.
All right. If anyone wants to follow up and do, I'm going to ask you one more question here that's a little bit personal, but it's important, and I think you're cool with me asking it. But if anyone wants to follow up on this, we do at Mixer G create courses. I do not have anywhere near the slickness of 80 or that he was aspiring to. Frankly, you saw my chest hair. You can see I don't even trim that, and I should. I trimmed my beard this morning. I should have just moved the clippers down and trim the chest hair, look a little nicer. So I don't even have that. But what I do have is people who are entrepreneurs who we grill before we even bring on to teach their courses. So one of the people who's on is, we mentioned Heaton Shaw. Heaton Shaw created Kiss Metrics, and he got help from a guy named Jason Evanosh, who did customer interviews with potential customers that Heaton Shaw wanted to have on Kissmetrics. He asked them what their problems were. He figured out their needs, and then Kissmetrics built small solutions to satisfy those needs. And then they went back and they asked more questions, and they did this whole process that AD went through, and it's explained by us in this course on Mixergy. So do a search for, I was going to say Evanosh, but frankly, if you do a search for Evanosh, you're going to misspell it. Let me see how to spell Evanosh. Do I even know it?
It's Evanesh, isn't it?
Is it Evanesh?
I think so.
Oh, did I say his name wrong? And I really want to work with the guy even more. Evanesh. I say Evanosh. You're right. It's spelled Evanesh. Jason Evanesh. E-V-A-N-I-S-H. See, never going to make it on CNBC. Jason Evanesh. Anyway, he did a really great course where he broke down that process. Cindy Alvarez, who worked with Heaton Shaw, did the exact same thing. Not the exact same thing. Also broke down this process. And I urge you, if you're on Mixergy right now, type in Cindy Alvarez or Jason Evanesh and check out those courses. If you're not part of Mixergy Premium, sign up already. I think you're really going to love it. And you're going to say to me, Andrew, why are you charging so little for it when these two courses are so fantastic? What you will not, unfortunately, get is community, and I know that's something that we need to add. I just don't know how to do it. All right, here's the thing. The final part, AD. I am looking at your interview here. The whole team apparently is involved in recruiting you. You must have gotten 50 emails from Andrea over the last few months. It took us 4 months and 21 days to get you to record today. Is that because you're taking a break, or is that because you just don't like us and you finally accepted only because Andrea would have hustled until you got here?
What's going on there, seriously? So initially, it was totally a break. When Andrea first reached out, I was in the middle of taking a break and just rebooting myself. And I only started working again full-time on a new product about 2 months ago. So that was the only reason. I promised I would not leave you in the lurch and not be on mixture.
No embarrassment in the whole process? It was no, hey, come on, guys, you really want me to talk about this? How about waiting till my next business succeeds and then have me on, and then as part of the conversation, we could talk about how there was this one business at one point that didn't do so well. Was that part of it?
So that's part of the strategy, is the more kind of publicity I get, so in a year's time, you're going to contact me again and say, like, AD, please come on board and, like, chat about the new business, what you've done there. So, it's all just strategic on my part.
All right. I do think it's important to leave what Tim Sykes says are breadcrumbs. He said, look, if all I do are interviews on Mixergy when things go great, I'm going to look like a liar. But if every once in a while when things aren't going well, I come back and I do an interview, even if it doesn't get me anything in the moment, when people go and do some research, they could see, there was this period where he didn't do so well, and he talked about it openly, and I learned a lot from it. And it's not just, hey, look at me, I'm doing great, look at me, I'm doing great. But here are the ups and downs of a guy who's working like everyone else, but he's delivering exceptional results unlike anyone else. Let's learn what he did. I'm looking forward to having you back on here. And Andrea, we'll start hounding you right now. We don't expect you to even do the interview now. We're going to start with anticipation that a year from now, we'll finally get you back on. And whether it is a year from now or 5 years from now or 10 years from now or even 10 days from now, I'm looking forward to it. I love the way you break down what you've done, and I've learned so much from you over the years, and it's an honor to have you on here in good times and bad. Thanks for doing this interview.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
All right. If you guys want to follow up or find a way to say thank you, AD, I think his personal site is just AD.me, right? ADII.me.
Yep. That's it.
Great site. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.